About SF podcast.
About SF is a resource center for speculative literature, science fiction, and education. We are a joint project of the University of Kansas, the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, and the Science Fiction Research Association, with generous support from Tor Books, the Heinlein Prize Trust, and several individual donors. Please visit the About SF website at www.aboutsf.com. For episode 4 of the About SF audio podcast, we are thrilled to share a recording of Frederick Pohl reading his story, Day Million. Mr. Pohl graciously recorded himself reading the story specifically for this podcast. Frederick Pohl's career as a writer and editor spans over 70 years from his first published work, Elegy to a Dead Planet, Luna, in 1937, to his most recent novel, All the Lives He Led, published by Tor in 2011. He is a multiple Nebula and Hugo Award winner, as well as a recipient of the National Book Award. Mr. Pohl's other awards are too numerous to list. His beloved works include The Space Merchants, written with Cyril Kornbluth, and the Heechee series of novels. Mr. Pohl blogs actively at www.thewaythefutureblogs.com. The theme for this year's 2011 Campbell Conference, hosted by the Center for the Study of Science Fiction in Lawrence, Kansas, is Alternating Currents, Frederick Pohl and Theodore Sturgeon. A reading of Mr. Pohl's and Mr. Sturgeon's works will be included with the other Campbell Conference events. Information about the 2011 Campbell Conference and the writing workshops hosted by the Center for the Study of Science Fiction is available at www.ku.edu/SF Center, or you can also find the Center for the Study of Science Fiction website by Googling CSSF and University of Kansas. Day Million, a story first published in 1966, is as keenly insightful in its exploration of human evolution, relationships, and gender as it was when first published. It is a great honor to have Mr. Pohl read this story for the podcast.
On this day I want to tell you about, which will be about 1,000 years from now, there were a boy, a girl, and a love story. Now, although I haven't said much so far, none of it is true. The boy was not what you and I would normally think of as a boy because he was 187 years old. Nor was the girl a girl for other reasons. And the love story did not entail that sublimation of the urge to rape and concurrent postponement of the instinct to submit which we at present understand in such matters. You won't care much for this story if you don't grasp these facts at once. If, however, you will make the effort, you'll likely enough find it jam-packed, chock-full, and tip-top crammed with laughter, tears, and poignant sentiment which may or may not be worthwhile. The reason the girl was not a girl was that she was a boy. How angrily you recoil from the page. You say, who the hell wants to read about a pair of queers? Calm yourself. There are no hot-breathing secrets of perversion for the good retrade. In fact, if you were to see the girl, you would not guess that she was in any sense a boy. Breasts 2, vagina 1, hips calipigeon, face hairless, supraorbital lobes non-existent. You would term her female at once, although it is true that you might wonder just what species she was a female of, being confused by the tail, the silky pelt, and the gillslets behind each ear. Now you recoil again. Cripes, man, take my word for it. This is a sweet kid, and if you, as a normal male, spent as much as an hour in a room with her, you would bend heaven and earth to get her in the sack. Dora, we will call her that, her, quote, name, unquote, was Omicron Dibe 7 Group Tauterus Testeritis 5314, the last part of which is a color specification corresponding to a shade of green. Dora, I say, was feminine, charming, and cute. I admit she doesn't sound that way. She was, as you might put it, a dancer. Her art involved qualities of intellect and expertise of a very high order, requiring both tremendous natural capacities and endless practice. It was performed in non-gravity, and I can best describe it by saying that it was something like the performance of a contortionist and something like classical ballet, maybe resembling Danilova's Dying Swan. It was also pretty damn sexy, in a symbolic way to be sure, but face it, most of the things we call sexy are symbolic, you know, except perhaps an exhibitionist's open fly. On Day Million, when Dora danced, the people who saw her panted, and you would too. About this business of her being a boy, it didn't matter to her audience that genetically she was male. It wouldn't matter to you if you were among them, because you wouldn't know it. Not unless you took a biopsy cutting of her flesh and put it under an electron microscope to find the XY chromosome. And it didn't matter to them, because they didn't care. Through techniques which are not only complex, but haven't yet been discovered, these people were able to determine a great deal about the aptitudes and easements of babies quite a long time before they were born. At about the second horizon of cell division, to be exact, when the segmenting egg is becoming a free blastocyst. And then they naturally help those aptitudes along. Wouldn't we, if we find a child with an aptitude for music, we give them a scholarship to Juilliard? If they found a child whose aptitudes were being a woman, they made him one. As sex has long been dissociated from reproduction, this was relatively easy to do and caused no trouble and no or very little comment. How much is very little? Oh, about as much as would be caused by our own tampering with divine will by filling a tooth. Less than would be caused by wearing a hearing aid. Does it still sound awful? Then look closely at the next busty babe you meet and reflect that she may be a Dora. For adults who are genetically male but somatically female are far from unknown even now. An accident of environment in the womb overwhelms the blueprints of heredity. The difference is that with us it happens only by accident and we don't know about it except after close study. Whereas the people of Day Million did it often on purpose because they wanted to. Well, that's enough to tell you about Dora. It would only confuse you to add that she was 7 feet tall and smelled of peanut butter. Let us begin our story. On Day Million, Dora swam out of her house, entered a transportation tube, was sucked briefly to the surface in its flow of water, and ejected in a plume of spray to an elastic platform in front of her rehearsal hall. Oh shit, she cried in pretty confusion, reaching out to catch her balance and finding herself tumbled against a total stranger whom we will call Don. They met cute. Don was on his way to have his legs renewed. Love was the farthest thing from his mind, but when absent-mindedly taking a shortcut across the landing platform for submarinites and finding himself drenched, he discovered his arms full of the loveliest girl he had ever seen. He knew at once they were meant for each other. "Will you marry me?" he asked. She said softly, "Wednesday," and the promise was like a caress. Don was tall, muscular, bronze, and exciting. His name was no more Don than Dora's was Dora. But the personal part of it was Adonis in tribute to his vibrant maleness, so we will call him Don for short. His personal color code in angstrom units was 5290, or only a few degrees bluer than Dora's 5314, a measure of what they had intuitively discovered at first sight, that they possessed many affinities of taste and interest. I despair of telling you exactly what it was that Don did for a living, I don't mean for the sake of making money. I mean for the sake of giving purpose and meaning to his life. Keep him from going off his nut with boredom. Except to say that it involved a lot of traveling. He traveled in interstellar spaceships. In order to make a spaceship go really fast, about 31 male and 7 genetically female human beings had to do certain things, and Don was one of the 31. Actually, he contemplated options. This involved a lot of explosion to radiation flux, not so much from his own station in the propulsive system, as in a spillover from the next stage where a genetic female preferred selections and the subnuclear particles making the selections she preferred demolished themselves in a shower of quanta. Well, you don't get a rat's ass for that, but it meant that Don had to be clad at all times in a skin of light, resilient, extremely strong, copper-colored metal. I have already mentioned this, but you probably thought I meant he was sunburned. More than that, he was a cybernetic man. Most of his rooted parts had long ago been replaced with mechanisms of vastly more permanent life and use. A cadmium centrifuge, not a heart, pumped his blood. His lungs moved only when he wanted to speak out loud. A cascade of osmotic filters rebreathed oxygen out of his own waste. In a way, he probably would have looked peculiar to a man from the 20th century, with his glowing eyes and seven-fingered hands. But to himself, and of course to Dora, he looked mighty manly and grand. In the course of his voyages, Don had circled Proxima Centauri, Procyon, and the puzzling worlds of Mirror City. He had carried agricultural templates to the planets of Canopus and brought back warm, witty pets from the pale companion of Aldebaran. Blue hot or red cool, he had seen 1,000 stars and their 10,000 planets. He had, in fact, been traveling the star lanes with only brief leaves on Earth for pushing 2 centuries. Well, you don't care about that either. It is people that make stories, not the circumstances they find themselves in. And you want to hear about these 2 people. Well, they made it. The great thing they had for each other grew and flowered and burst into fruition on Wednesday, just as Dora had promised. They met at the encoding room with a couple of well-wishing friends apiece to cheer them on. And while their identities were being taped and stored, they smiled and whispered to each other and bore the joke of their friends with flushing repartee. Then they exchanged their mathematical analogs and went away, Dora to her dwelling beneath the surface of the sea and Don to his ship. It was an idyll, really. They lived happily ever after, or anyway until they decided not to bother anymore and died. Of course, they never set eyes on each other again. Oh, I can see you now, you eaters of charcoal broiled steak, scratching on incipient bunions with one hand and holding this story with the other while the stereo plays Dandy or Monk. You don't believe a word of it, do you? Not for 1 minute. People wouldn't live like that, you say with an irritated and not amused grunt, as you get up to put fresh ice in a stale drink. And yet, there's Dora, hurrying back to the flushing commuter pipes toward her underwater home. She prefers it there, has had herself somatically altered to breathe the stuff. If I tell you with what sweet fulfillment she fits the recorded analog of Don into the symbol manipulator, hooks herself in and turns herself on. If I try to tell you any of that, you will simply stare or glare and grumble, what the hell kind of lovemaking is this? And yet I assure you, and I really do assure you, that Dora's ecstasies are as creamy and passionate as any of James Bond's lady spies, and one hell of a lot more so than anything you are going to find in real life. Go ahead, glare and grumble. Dora doesn't care. If she thinks of you at all, her 30 times great-great-grandfather, she thinks you're a pretty primordial sort of brute. You are. Why, Dora is farther removed from you than you are from the Australopithecines of 5,000 centuries ago. You could not swim a second in the strong currents of her life. You don't think progress goes in a straight line, do you? Do you recognize that it is an ascending, accelerating, maybe even exponential curve? It takes hell's own time to get started. But when it goes like a bomb. And you scotch-drinking steak eater in your relaxicizer chair, you just barely lighted the prime cord of the series. What is it now, the 600th or 700th day after Christ? Dora lives in day million, 1,000 years from now. Her body fats are polyunsaturated like Crisco. Her wastes are hemodialyzed out of her bloodstream while she sleeps. That means she doesn't have to go to the bathroom. On whim, to pass a slow half hour, she can command more energy than the entire nation of Portugal can spend today, and use it to launch a weekend satellite or to remold a crater on the moon. She loves Don very much. She keeps his every gesture, mannerism, nuance, touch of hand, thrill of intercourse, passions of law, kiss, stored in symbolic mathematical form. And when she wants him, all she has to do is turn the machine on, and she has him. And Don, of course, has Dora. Adrift on a sponson city a few hundred yards over her head, or orbiting Arcturus 50 light years away, Don has only to command his own symbol manipulator to rescue Dora from the ferrite files and bring her to life for him. And there she is. And rapturously, tirelessly, they bawl all night. Not in the flesh, of course, but then his flesh has been extensively altered and it wouldn't really be much fun. He doesn't need the flesh for pleasure. Genital organs feel nothing, neither do hands, nor breasts, nor lips. They are only receptors, accepting and transmitting impulses. It is the brain that feels. It is the interpretation of those impulses that makes agony or orgasm. And Don's symbol manipulator gives him the analog of cuddling, the analog of kissing, the analog of wildest, most ardent hours with the eternal, exquisite, and incorruptible analog of Dora, or Diane, or Sweet Rose, or Laughing Alicia. For to be sure, they have each of them exchanged analogs before and will again. Balls, you say, it looks crazy to me. And you, with your aftershave lotion and your little red car, pushing papers across the desk all day and chasing tail all night, tell me, just how the hell do you think you would look to Tiglath-Pileser or Attila the Hun?
This concludes our broadcast. Thank you for listening to the About SF podcast. Please visit us at www.aboutsf.com.